Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very pleased to have as my guest William T. Vollman, whose most recent book is Rising Up and Rising Down. It's published in 7 volumes from McSweeney's. A abridgment of the book is coming out in paperback from HarperCollins, but it is the complete book that we'll be referring to when we talk during this interview. Now, usually I don't talk about nonfiction on Bookworm. It's all literary fiction and poetry. But I found in reading Rising Up and Rising Down, so many of Vollman's concerns are expressed in a kind of axiomatic form in this book, and so many incidents that later make their way into the fiction appear here. This is a book that you began when?
Probably about 25 years ago, because it took me 23 years to write.
And who was the person who began it?
Well, you know, when I was in college, I was very interested in the anti-nuclear movement. And I attended a blockade occupation at Seabrook, New Hampshire. The reactor was not quite online. And it was a very, very interesting experience to find all these people who were dedicated to nonviolence fail in their stated objective, which was to, you know, with typical exaggeration, shut down the nuclear plant. And they were defeated because of the violence of authority. In this case, the New Hampshire National Guard. So I started wondering what their objectives should have been, and if they were so sure that nuclear power was this dangerous that it was going to cause, let's say, 10,000 fatalities, then would it have been justified for them to be violent and kill maybe 9,000 people? For instance, should they have pulled a September 11th and crashed a jet into the dome of the reactor or something to prevent this thing from being built? And how can you really talk about this stuff? Is it possible for there to be a moral calculus for violence? One of the things that I came quickly to understand, you know, a very basic thing, is that in violence, particularly in war, we refer to proportionality and discrimination. Discrimination means that we are committing our violence against the appropriate targets, combatants. Proportionality means that the violence that we are responding to is hopefully more severe than the violence that we are replying with. So these are sort of some basic things, but it became more and more complicated for me. And I myself am not a violent person, but I write about violent people often, and I've seen some violence in my life. And in the process of working on Rising Up and Rising Down, my interests widened, I guess. And I started thinking that this should not only have a moral calculus, but that the only way to arrive at this moral calculus was through induction, which meant that I had to read a lot more widely and think a lot more widely and be interested in and appreciative of many, many more things. So in the end, I guess it is more of a middle-aged person's book. It started off being a young person's book, and I thought, okay, this book is going to show us how to do this and not do that. And now it's more about if someone else does this or does that, how do we understand it and how do we judge it and how can we talk with other people who have different ideas about what to do?
Let me tell you how strangely this book affected me. One of the things I've always wondered or suspected when I've read your fiction is the feeling of not knowing the stance from which these utterances emerge. That is to say, I haven't known how aggressive they are or how passive or instructive or defensive. Sometimes I've said to people, what I don't understand about Volman, sometimes I think he's a sadist who doesn't know he's secretly a masochist or vice versa. And so when I began this book, its introduction came as something of a slap in the face. I realized that you were beyond a lot of my concerns of that sort. For me, the kinds of violence that you're writing about, I encounter mostly in my reading. And I live in a kind of cloistered terror about the encounter. Whereas this book asks me to accept that I'm in a very small, privileged minority of the world capable of ignoring the actualities of daily violence, massive violence, and then asks me to understand that there has to be, in a violent world which has never known a period without a gulag, without a concentration camp, these things occurring on every continent we know and in almost every culture, that we have to ask the question, when is violence justified and what is unjustifiable violence? And that even if we ask these questions, this doesn't stop unjustifiable violence. So a kind of idealism in my life is violated by your very beginning point, and I realize that all of the books begin after that point of understanding that we live in a Hobbesian world with human nature as really capable of being as debased as imaginable. Now, it's hard for me to imagine the person who lives in that being able to do as much writing as you do. In other words, the level of despair that would encompass me would litigate against the vast projects you take on. How does writing help with these recognitions?
Well, first of all, Michael, I would say that probably you and I are far more alike as people than we are different, just given what our interests are. I have always felt that when I pick up a book and read it, that I'm carried into some other world. And I assume that it's that way for you too, and I know that,
of course,
the thing that you principally do is read. So you're constantly experiencing this encounter with the otherness of the book, the otherness of the author. And if there's anything that I can do as a writer that I would most want to do, it would be to help people accept this otherness and to have that acceptance widen so that it might not necessarily be the case that a lot of my readers would want to, let's say, become friends with homeless people if they didn't already. But maybe if they read about some of my homeless characters, they might feel slightly less threatened or disgusted or sad or angry or something if they passed by one of these people. And then I would be happy if that were my objective, you know, if I could do that. And I feel that That is also the case with violence. I feel like violence is the ultimate otherness.
One of the early chapters here is an itemization of weapons and their aesthetic beauty. Why?
I think that everything has two sides. I believe as a novelist that flat characters are sometimes convenient, but you always need to have a round character. And a round character is somebody who is good and evil, somebody you can see around, as they say. So in my European short stories, when I write about Hitler, it's not enough to just say that Hitler was evil. We know that, and that doesn't really help us. What makes Hitler more human, and to me actually more frightening, is that he was really nice to his secretaries, you know? And we need people to know those details. What makes weapons more potent is that they can be beautiful. Whether or not we ourselves find them to be beautiful, the fact that so many of their owners cherish their weapons and are proud of them, and that throughout history, people have felt distinguished, you know, by the beautiful swords that they've owned, the fantastic guns that they've commissioned people to embellish with jewels and gold and so on and so forth. This is really a glorification of violence, and that's what we're faced with. I remember years ago in the 70s going to see Apocalypse Now with this woman, and I asked her what she thought, and she said, you know, I just thought that those explosions were so beautiful. And at first I was really revolted. And then I thought, yeah, but she's right. That's one of the things that they were trying to do. And violence is seductive. And violence is not always wrong. Violence can be beautiful. So that's something that we have to accept about it. And if we deny the beauty of violence, we are blinding ourselves to part of its power and part of its reality.
I'm speaking to William Vollmann. The occasion is his 7-volume investigation of violence, Rising Up and Rising Down, published by McSweeney's. And from the time when I got this book, it was when it first came out, which was around 7 months ago, I looked at it with interest as a literary object. In the months since, politically, I've become aware that it's a book probably that I can't do without, that I am living in a world erupting in the kind of violences and retaliations and escalations that this book describes, and that you've been following as a journalist for years now. And you say in your preface that essentially you ain't seen nothing yet. How does a person learn to live in this world? Did it come? You describe yourself, although I'm somehow feeling some doubt, as someone who entered it protestingly, but the evidence isn't there in the writing. You seem to have been a writer who always lived in the possibility of moral extremism.
Well, I suppose that, one of my formative experiences was my little sister's death. The fact that she drowned when I was supposed to be taking care of her, and that I really didn't do a good job, and that I failed and suffered a certain amount of blame and still blame myself to some extent, means that I have to say, okay, in some sense, I myself am a murderer. Therefore, if I talk with other murderers, I have to try to judge them the way that I would judge myself. In The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky says that maybe the only way to live, if we are really brothers and sisters, is that if somebody commits a murder in Timbuktu, we have to say, I am that murderer. I accept responsibility because that person, that man, that murderer is my brother. And this, of course, is an insane and impossible thing. At the same time, you know, maybe it points to something. And what I used to think when I started writing Rising Up and Rising Down was that I would be able to say, okay, now I know why it is that this act is good and that act is evil, and this person is my friend and that person is my enemy. But I just don't have it in myself to do that. And this book cannot and refuses to do that. Osama bin Laden has a point of view. Many people, not me, feel that he has a legitimate point of view. So what are we going to do about that? Until we understand what his point of view is and why more and more people think that it is legitimate, we are not going to be able to address the terrible threat that his followers are creating.
You know, I agree with you completely, and yet what I'm interested in as much as the subject is you as a writer. I find that the idea of the enormous and sometimes infinite project accompanies writers whose interest in death and violence. Sod, for instance, in the 120 Days of Sodom, William Burroughs, the sense, at least for the first half of his career, that his writing was a vast articulation of a multi-tiered heaven and hell that could not be completely described, that book after book were more details of this particular system of the inferno, and in fact that he would decompose the books, literally so, that he'd begin to slash them up and publish the results.
Right.
You're one of the few writers, I think, that your readers know that there are several books more of your Seven Dreams series. I know that there's a book on Europe called Europe Central coming out, a very big novel from Viking, that you're at work on a history of the coastline between Mexico and California. What does this projection into the future of projects have to do with your aesthetic? Because it seems necessary to it.
Well, you know, as you've observed, I am concerned with death and oblivion. And I like to think that the written word can outlast the individual human being.
Yes.
And that in a way, I suppose in a primitive way, I could say that written words are like bullets that I'm shooting at death. And if I shoot enough of them, you know, maybe I will be able to defend myself against this fear that, of course, we all have. Because I might talk a lot about how I would like to accept this, but I'm still working on it. That's all any of us can do, is just keep working on it. In the case of Rising Up, Rising Down, I would say that what made it different from a Sadian project was that I didn't really want it to be so long, and I didn't particularly relish the details or the writing. I wanted it to be completed much sooner, but it seemed that the only way to do anything worthwhile was to create some kind of a system, and creating this system was very cumbersome for me, so I proceeded in my pedantic Scandinavian German way and made my system in my numbered moral calculus. and that was all that I could do. In the case of the seven dreams, in a way, it is sort of the same thing. I originally thought that my seven dreams would be one book published in seven chapters. And then these chapters continued to grow into separate volumes. But in a way, I think that has to do more with the process by which I write, because I don't outline, or very, very rarely. I have sometimes for one or two of the seven dreams, but mostly I don't. But when I write a sentence, I will very often begin inserting qualifications and clauses into that sentence to get it as exact and complete as I can. And so the sentence grows into something unrecognizable. And that's really what happens with these projects as well as the sentences. The question, when is violence justified, requires an answer that's like a telephone book. And that's not what I expected.
What several things amaze me about the project and about your work in general. It does not gloat. It does not gloat about these details. There isn't a lubricious delight in them. This is an accusation sometimes made, but I don't think it's an accurate one. More than that, it's an enormously responsible book. One of the things that I notice that people writing about Rising Up and Rising Down, first of all, let's acknowledge that at 3,000-some pages, most of its critics haven't read all of it. And I noticed that what they passed over was the storytelling, that there are portraits of Caesar, Joan of Arc, a whole network of historical characters dealing with issues of violence and power.
Yeah, thanks for noticing that. I'm very proud of what I did with Caesar.
Yeah, and that the book is therefore full of narrative and character portrait. And what it's most like, it seems to me, is that comparative mythology that you find in Hero with a Thousand Faces on the one hand, or in Lord Raglan's book about the hero, where you're setting next to one another a continuum of examples and determining a kind of, via a kind of crucible process, what is the essence of moral behavior in regard to violence. These essentially, what would you call them, brief lives, I guess.
Exactly.
Become the spine of the book, and they're mirrored by the journalism at the end as you're writing about your encounter with an opium lord. Do you see a Joan of Arc today to balance that Joan of Arc? The opium lord seems his own Caesar, but who are those figures of hope that you might be able to isolate? I needed them.
Gosh, that's a hard one. Well, perhaps some of the younger generation of writers and journalists. It seems to me that the only thing that we can do to combat violence and horror is to learn better empathy and better communication. The only people who can do that are writers, poets, and a very, very few idealistic politicians. There was a time which Gandhi did it. Maybe Mandela did it. I don't know. I think that in our own country, we are definitely going through a time of deterioration, and it's unclear to me that we have anybody who can unify people such as Joan of Arc did.
Now tell me, you say about Gandhi that his work is fueled by anger. Is that the case with your own work too, for all of its decision not to judge or its desire not to judge? Is it generated by anger?
I don't think so. I hope not. Of course, we never really know ourselves. And part of the adventure of being alive is constantly being confounded by the fact that we really don't know ourselves. But I would say that that the book is fueled, if by any so-called negative emotion, probably by sorrow. It has made me so terribly sad over the years to see all these horrid things. And I keep thinking, isn't there some way to integrate them? One of the things that I was studying when I wrote my World War II stories was just a little bit of Jungian psychology. And the Jungians say, well, I guess actually the Freudians do to some extent, that every time consciousness forms a structure, which it has to do in order to organize itself and enact the day-to-day business of being alive, it has to repress other things. And because this repressed content is part of reality, you know, it will have its due. It will have its revenge. And we always need some kind of message from the unconscious, from the repressed. That message will keep trying to break through, whether it's through a nightmare or perhaps through a September 11th bombing. So we have to figure out what the repressed content is. If we continue to deny it, it will continue to take its revenge. If we can expose it and look at it and try somehow to integrate it and say, all right, yeah, we are human beings. This is who we are. Therefore, we have to expect this. And now maybe there's some way that we can manage this. That's going to help us. Of course, as soon as we do that, we're creating a new structure and there's going to be new repressed content. It's an endless process.
I've been speaking with William T. Vollman on the occasion of my reading of Rising Up and Rising Down, which has been published by McSweeney's Press with a recent abridgment published by HarperCollins. Thank you, Bill, for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
You can read an excerpt from Rising Up and Rising Down on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Warner. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.